Please call the next case.
Brooks Buck et al. Versus Wahlstrom, Melissa Y. York, Deborah Y. Collins, Appellant's Counsel, Deborah K. Rose, Appellee's Counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Melissa York, and I have the pleasure of representing Tyron Riddick, a current member of the City of Suffolk School Board and former board chair. My colleague, Deborah Collins, represents former school board member Judith Brooks Buck. I will be arguing on behalf of both of the defendants today, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. We are before the court on an interlocutory appeal of a denial of immunity in the context of a defamation claim filed by Deborah Wahlstrom. The defamation claim arises out of a May 26, 2023, notice of alleged violations of school board norms with attached narrative. Brooks Buck authored the narrative, and Riddick, as chair of the school board, issued the notice and narrative to the school board members and superintendent.
Can I ask you this? Was the remark in that narrative that suggested that Wahlstrom had committed crime, perjury, in the court, was that integral to a legitimate legislative function, or was it a gratuitous attack on a private citizen who is targeted by this alleged defendant?
It was integral, Your Honor. The notice outlines the alleged norms that the other school board member, Dr. Brenningham, was alleged to have violated. Absent the narrative which set forth the bases for those violations.
So it was integral for that narrative to actually state that this plaintiff committed perjury. That was integral to a legislative function.
Yes, Your Honor. The narrative is giving Dr. Brenningham notice of her alleged violations, and one of those dealt with and involved her interactions with Ms. Wahlstrom. And the policies entitled her to notice of any violation and afforded an opportunity
to
respond.
What did Mrs. Brittingham have to do with the perjury in the lower court? What relevance was it there?
So the issue was Dr. Brittingham interfering with the day-to-day operation of the schools, in even going so far as to bring her own specialists in to interpret data.
What does the perjury charge, which is a crime, and if it's untrue, would be defamation, have to do with that?
It has to do with the credibility of the specialists that she's bringing and interjecting into the operations of the schools.
That's integral to the legislative process for a legislator, whether local or state, to allegedly defame a friend, a colleague of another member in the context of disciplining that member? That's not a little far afield?
We don't believe so, Your Honor. It was outlining the bases
for the
violations.
But what's the end result? Following up, what's the end result of the discipline? Let's assume that all sorts of disciplinary rules were violated. And let's assume that the school board found that there was, in fact, a breach of the rules. In the worst case scenario, how does that relate to the creation of legislation or legislative activity?
So courts have held that disciplining a school board or disciplining a member of a legislative body is a core legislative function. They have to be able to self-regulate themselves. That is a legislative function. And so the notice was issued. It was issued only to the school board members and the superintendent. There is to be a closed session at which the violations would be discussed.
But is it a legislative function that we're focused on, or are we more focused on the creation of legislation?
It is a legislative function, and that's where the record and the case law gets a little confusing, because there's a reliance on Isle of Wight, which deals with the absolute privilege in a defamation case for statements made to a legislative body. Much like if I were speaking in court, I could not be sued for defamation for something I said because there's an absolute privilege for statements made in a judicial proceeding. There's also an absolute privilege for statements made in a legislative proceeding. However, we're not relying upon the absolute privilege accorded to a legislative proceeding, in which case the body has to be acting in a legislative capacity. We're dealing with legislative immunity, which this court has said in Davenport involves a legitimate sphere of legislative activity, and it's broader than actually creating legislation.
Assuming for a moment that this is all part of legislative activity, if it is a legislative activity, and a further assuming, I think your position is that 15-2-1405 provides immunity, and then there's common law legislative immunity, and that they're different things.
Yes.
Can you name me anything that 15-2-1405 would immunize a member of a governing body for that common law legislative immunity would not also cover?
Yes. And there's a body of case law that says, for example, firing an employee is not a legislative act.
Well, but if the school board entertains a motion to fire the superintendent, I mean, that's a decision of the school board, right? Aren't they making that in their legislative capacity?
One would think so, but the case law says no. The case law said that that's an administrative function. So if the school board were to fire the superintendent, that would be an administrative function. If it was eliminating a field of positions and making a budgetary cut, the courts have held that that's a legislative function.
Well, then it seems to me that your argument folds back on yourself, because how can it be a legislative function if it goes to punishment, firing, termination, discipline, if entertaining the actual motion and voting on it as exercising your legislative authority as a member of a legislative body, a school board, if that's not a legislative function, and I concede that we've kind of said that, then how in the world can disciplining a member be part of a legislative function? Because isn't it the same thing?
It's different, because you're disciplining a member of the body, the legislative body, and the legislative body has, as a function of being a body, the duty to discipline itself, as opposed to taking disciplinary action or firing an employee of the body. And this court has held that firing an individual employee is an administrative function to which legislative immunity is not afforded. So 15.2-1405 would afford a member who perhaps made a statement in the course of firing that employee, it would afford that person immunity because it's a discretionary and governmental
function. How about if the statement was intentionally false?
1405 would not apply for intentional, willful, reckless conduct.
Okay. And do you agree that defamation is definitionally an intentional tort?
It is, but there's an intent element. You can have a knew it was false or should have known it was false implies a negligence standard. And then there's a heightened standard if you were acting with reckless disregard or willful and wanton conduct. So there is a level of intent element with a defamation.
If immunity under 15.2-1405 and 801... 223.2 and common law legislative immunity are all different things, and it seems to me you argue that they are in fact different things. Didn't you have to plead them all?
And we did, Your Honor. And so we pled legislative immunity. We pled.
That's the common law one. Okay, I got that.
That's the common law legislative immunity. We pled sovereign immunity, and we pled,
which is not statutory immunity.
And we pled 801.223.2. 15.2-1405 is a codification of sovereign law immunity. It just obviates...
Well, wait a minute. You just told me they were different things.
There's 801.223.2. We hadn't yet talked about sovereign immunity, Your Honor. 15.2-1405 is a codification of sovereign law immunity. It simply obviates the need to go through the James versus Jane factors for these individuals. It outlines that they have immunity without needing to go through those factors, which you would do for an employee of an immune entity. Here, the General Assembly has simply codified that sovereign immunity. So 15.2-1405 is sovereign immunity. We have statutory immunity under 801.223.2, and we have common law legislative immunity.
Given that this is done on demur, and we have the allegation that we have defamation, wouldn't that always fall within 223.2b. Now, if we're just stuck with the plaintiff's allegations, how could you ever win that on demur?
So
unless they failed to state a claim for defamation.
Well, they have to allege facts that plausibly support the allegation of malice or the requisite intent. And here, if we look at the facts that relate to the only remaining allegedly defamatory statement at issue, there are no facts that statement was made knowing it was false with reckless disregard as to whether it was false. There were facts riddled throughout the complaint as to the other statements that this trial court has dismissed. But with respect to this fact, the only fact or the only statement at issue in the case, there are insufficient facts to overcome the immunity provided by either sovereign immunity or 801.223.2.
And this should be decided on demur?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
This should be decided on demur?
Yes, Your Honor. The immunity loses much of its effectiveness if the parties are forced to go through discovery and expend the cost of litigation. It should be decided
Counsel,
at its earliest point.
Did you file a plea and bar?
We did not, Your Honor.
Okay. And ma'am, ultimately, what is the proper process when you are alleging or asserting The defenses that you are stating, the legislative defenses, sovereign immunity, what is the proper vehicle by which to bring that?
This court has held that those can be brought on a demur if reading
what is the proper way, ma'am? Is it a plea and bar?
It can be brought either way. But this in Messina versus Burden, that was a demur case, and this court upheld the finding of sovereign immunity.
But when you choose to go with the demur, if we believe that the allegations of defamation are sufficiently pled, then definitionally she's within the exception of 223.2B.
If you find the allegations, by filing a demur, we choose not to put on evidence in a plea, and we have to accept the facts in the complaint as true and read them in the light most favorable to the plaintiff.
And all reasonable inferences that flow therefrom.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can I go back to my first question, which is when I read the briefs, I see basically like a Venn diagram, and it's this immunity, that immunity, the other immunity. But there's never in your brief a specific focus on the perjury allegation. And all throughout the law, the word integral is used. Whenever any of these courts are talking about, even the U.S. Supreme Court is talking about the nature of the common law immunity. It's not that you're engaged in a legislative function. It's the thing that's being complained about is integral, which is pretty close to essential. How is it essential or integral to allegedly defame a private citizen in a dispute between two members of the school board? Why was that necessary to say? Well, why was it integral to use the language of the case law?
So it's integral to the norms that Dr. Brittingham was alleged to have violated. Her bringing Ms. Wahlstrom into town hall meetings, relying on her to put data forth, to make statements to the public about the...
Did the perjury that's being alleged have anything to do with the issues that we're talking about in the dispute between these two members of the school board?
The allegation of perjury stemmed from the FOIA litigation that had preceded several years prior. And as we set forth in our reply brief, the court can take judicial notice of the transcript. And in fact, Ms. Wahlstrom did provide false testimony in that proceeding. So there's
the
a truth.
Did the false testimony deal with the stacking or not stacking of the chairs?
Yes, Your Honor. I see I'm past my 3 minutes remaining. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Debbie Rose, and I represent the appellee, Deborah Wahlstrom. While this case raises complex issues of immunity from civil liability afforded to public officials, the simple issue before this court is best summarized by Honorable Alfred W. Bates during the demur hearing when he asked the appellant's counsel, but what are the limits? You know, it seems as though you're acting as though they have no limits. There have to be some limits. You can't just simply say, in the context of a city council or school board's work, that they can just say, repeat, point out any scurrilous thing they want.
But in a system that assiduously believes in the separation of powers, isn't a legislative body's consideration of disciplining one of its own members a quintessentially legislative function?
It may be. And in this matter, the appellee, Ms. Wahlstrom, is not arguing that the current legislative format framework doesn't apply or work here. She's saying that the facts of this case take it squarely outside of the whether or not there is an immunity under common law, and it places it squarely within the exceptions to the statutory immunity under any of the analysis applied. So whether it is a function of a legislative in the process of a nexus to creating legislation or a core legislative function, the facts here as applied to those standards, those criteria under either Davenport or under Isle of Wight, these are both, the facts do not place their conduct within the sphere of immunity. So the appellee takes that position that there are limits within the current legal framework of what public officials may do with immunity. The appellant's conduct in this case places them outside any immunity protection, and the appellant's attempts to retrofit the facts of this case into any immunity boxes must fail, as this case is not analogous to the...
May I interrupt you for a second?
Yes.
Is there any evidence in the history or the protocols for the school board of, under the manual 2-26:1, of using a narrative, a factual narrative, as sort of a factual statement of the reasons? Is that a novel thing in this case, or is there actually some history of that being used?
I can't, the creation of school, the adoption of school board norms is somewhat of a new thing. I'm gonna speak a little bit from my own perspective, having been a school board member in Loudoun County for 8 years. This is a newer development among school boards to try and internally kind of oversee board members. It has no weight other than just to kind of publicly draw attention potentially to school board members who have violated some agreed upon internal norms.
In the policy manual, does it anywhere say, well, here's how you go about doing this?
And that,
for heaven's sakes,
no.
Don't
yeah.
defame a private citizen in the process.
It does not require the policy that was in place at the time. It has since been changed recently in Suffolk County, in Suffolk Public Schools, but the policy that is in question did not require a narrative. It only required a notice. And to that extent, the notice alerting a board member that there have been allegations that they violated the norm and that they would have a right to be heard on those allegations in a closed session, that's it. That's all that policy required. It did not require any drafting of any separate documents. It didn't require distributing any separate documents. That wasn't there. I don't know if that's something, how long that policy has been in place there. Obviously, each school board can craft their own policy on school board norms as they like and agree to their norms as they would like. In that case, this one only required a notice and an opportunity to be heard. That's it.
What statements in the narrative were alleged to be defamatory?
In the original complaint, there were statements about Ms. Wahlstrom's resume, her educational background, her employment history, whether or not she had violated Ms. Brooks Buck's privacy rights, and then, of course, the allegation that she had committed perjury. The perjury
allegation
statement,
is all those things are false, and
yes.
Actual malice attends to it?
Yes, that was the allegation. And
was the allegation of actual malice in the pleading?
Yes, yes. We argued that these were knowing and intentionally false statements that were based on their ill will towards her, and we offered as context for that the background, and of which this court has ruled many times that the context of defamatory statements before and after can be considered as part of, you know, that consideration of whether actual malice exists. And we did do that by alerting, highlighting the video, that is part of the record here, and, you know, observing that video can only be, you know, kind of described as theatrics and not an actual concern about Ms. Brooks Buck, that she was she's a regular contributor with her opinion and her expertise, and it is not appreciated by a couple board members, and they have repeatedly made that known, and that was alleged in the complaint.
So your position is 1405 wholly supersedes the common law?
To the extent that it is incompatible with the common law. So to that extent that the General Assembly's intent is that there be some abrogation of immunity where there are intentional violations, intentional misconduct, such as intentional torts, such as defamation. So with respect to the time, you know, knowing that your honors have already fully read the briefs and the record in this case, I just want to focus my last few moments here on the appellant's reply brief. And the appellant's attempt to force this lawsuit into one that's against them in their official capacity in order to gain immunity protection is far from persuasive. The complaint and the allegations contained therein do not support a finding of official capacity under the test outlined in Martin v. Wood. The conduct here is not inextricably linked to the official conduct. The appellant Brooks Buck made choices. She chose to draft a narrative of her allegations against a fellow board member, and she chose to include that narrative in a litany of unrelated false and defamatory statements about Ms. Wahlstrom. These actions were not required, and they were not required to be published to other board members and division counsel. These are personal choices fueled by ill will toward Ms. Wahlstrom. The complaint also alleges sufficient facts demonstrating that the ill will was motivated by their conduct, and it is what it is. This is a cheap shot at Ms. Wahlstrom, you know, wrapped in a.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Would this be any different if the statements were verbal as opposed to being in writing?
No.
So if there were a closed meeting of the school board and somebody made these statements to other school board members and determined in deciding whether or not to discipline a school board member, they would be subject to defamation action?
Yes, I would argue.
If one of the school board members, I guess, breached the confidentiality of the group?
Yes, I would argue that those statements would never be protected under the FOIA laws, that comments about a private citizen unrelated to discipline of a board member would never fall under the protection of a FOIA, under the elements that are outlined for FOIA protection.
So are closed sessions recorded?
No.
So how would FOIA get to it?
Only if a board member were to disclose the statements that were not FOIA-able. And that does happen sometimes. People do, you know, there are instances where issues do get discussed that should not be in a closed session.
Okay.
Yeah. One last question from me. In the Edwards case, 2016, we quoted from the Brewster U.S. Supreme Court case, and there's a long paragraph distinguishing between political motives with a little p and truly integral legislative functions. And it said, for example, that legislators outside of the legislative activities under the speech and debate clause, which is the precursor to our common law, the 1870 provision, that they're inapplicable. This protection is inapplicable when the things are political in nature rather than legislative, and even outline that news releases for activities related to the legislature would be outside the common law and speech and debate concepts. So the worry I have in this case is we're using big circles and pressing everything into it, but there are caveats to every single one of these circles, and one of which is it's got to be integral. Going back to the chief's question, if some wholly defamatory statement is made between the seven of us 5 minutes from now, having nothing to do with anything that's part of this case or part of our, then that would be defamatory. We couldn't hide behind some government privilege. Is the allegations that you allege of the political animus relevant because of Edwards?
I don't know that I qualify their animus necessarily in a political, purely political motivated. There is definitely a personal dislike.
Bear in mind, Edwards carved off purely political as something other than integral to the legislative function.
So,
in other words, a hit job on your political enemies.
Yes, and I mean, and to the extent that in this case, Ms. Wahlstrom's comments are critical of their performance, her repeated attendance in and public comments to the Suffolk Public Schools School Board. She's critical of their performance in their job, their effectiveness, and so to that extent that they're motivated by that politically, yes. I mean, that would place them within that category as well. And I want to just make one quick point too, that the fact that this is the Ms. Wahlstrom did not sue the board members, the appellees, in their official capacity. The complaint never indicated the claims were directed toward them in their official capacity, and Suffolk Public Schools retaining two separate counsel through their insurance carrier, which would be unusual, then it's because they chose that option under Virginia Code 22.1-82, which grants school boards the authority to provide for the litigation costs of members sued in their for acts in their official capacity. The appellants were not forced into taking this position, and any damages that would be paid by Suffolk Public Schools was because they self-selected that choice. And for the first time in their brief, in the reply brief, the appellants offer an explanation for their belief that Ms. Wahlstrom committed perjury. Aside from this being an evidentiary issue for a jury, a witness correcting their memory on the stand about an immaterial fact is not perjury, and it's not a proper basis for overturning the demur in this ruling in this case. And in closing, Ms. Wahlstrom is not asking for this court to change the existing legal framework implicated in this case. It's her position the appellant's conduct is outside the protection of legislative and sovereign immunity and instead lands squarely in the exceptions to statutory immunity. We agree with Ms. York when she replied, a balance and reason exists to Judge Bates' question about whether it was her position that you can say anything you want. That's question before this court today. Does this court want to strike that balance of interest such that a public official can choose to say any scurrilous thing about any person that is unrelated to official business in the public interest so that so long as it is wrapped within a document or a proceeding only tangentially connected to their official conduct? And if so, we would argue that the immunity doctrine meant to protect public officials performing their duties would become a weapon to be used against citizens and discourage participation in public discourse. And for these reasons, we and those argued in the pleadings, we respectfully request that this court uphold the demur ruling. I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You have 2 minutes and 48 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to note that these were closed session materials that are not subject to FOIA, so they were disseminated only to the school board members and the superintendent. The policy requires that a school board member alleged to have violated any norms or protocols herein will be issued a formal notice of the alleged violations and afforded an opportunity to respond to the alleged allegations in a closed meeting of the school board. If we look at the notice simply asserts which sections were violated, but doesn't provide the specifics. The notice alone would not afford Dr. Brittingham the opportunity to respond to the allegations against her in the closed session.
I'd like you to address Justice Kelsey's concept that it has to be integral to the legislative activity. And I'm not asking you to concede that accusing her of perjury in a general district court case isn't integral. I know that's your position, that they're all linked together and it's for us to decide whether it is. But at the outside, if I attach to a notice, blah, 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 and by the way, Wes Russell is a lying horse thief, and I have nothing to do with anything. It's just thrown in. It's completely gratuitous. No one's alleging there's any linkage, but it's in the document. It's in this notice that's going to the board. Would you concede that that's outside the legislative immunity, or is, hey, it's in? They can literally say anything they want in this document about anybody, and it's privileged, and it's they're immunized.
The case law tells us that the immunity is absolute, but I struggle with, because of the integral requirement, if it's something is so far unrelated that there could be an argument that it is not protected.
So you concede there is an integral requirement?
Yes. Okay. And here we have the accusations against Dr. Brittingham and about interfering with the day-to-day operations of the schools, even going so far as to bring her own specialist to interpret SPS data at a town hall for her borough that addressed the schools. And then it goes on to address the issues with Dr. Wahlstrom being the consultant. And the statement at issue, Dr. Brittingham's consultant has consistently presented misinformation in public before the school board and perjured herself in court before the district judge. Dishonesty with the public does not appear to be a problem.
Given the outcome of the FOIA litigation, is her statement about stacking chairs material? I mean, it seems to me it's immaterial as a matter of law.
But the question is whether there was reckless disregard or knowing that this was false. And if you have a layperson knowing that there was false testimony under oath, or inaccurate testimony under oath in the proceedings, I don't see how they could have acted with reckless disregard when making the statements.
And that would be interesting if we weren't here on demurrer, but we are.
I understand. But my point is that the statement is linking to Dr. Brittingham's conduct in involving Dr. Wahlstrom in the proceedings, and it is integral to the disciplinary action. So we would ask that the ruling be overturned.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.
All rise.